Hey everyone, it's Zach. This episode is all about the legacy of the great early 2010s Miami Heat and how they've been overlooked, I think, a little bit in decade retrospective coverage. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please take a minute to rate the show and leave a review. Before we get to today's episode, I want to remind you about another great NBA podcast, The Hoop Collective, with friend of the program Brian Windhorst. Brian, Jackie McMullen, the Hall of Famer, Tim McMahon, and others get together twice a week to bring you the latest news, insights, and developments from around the league. You can find The Hoop Collective wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from the Dan Le Batard Studios in South Beach, where to me, at the Clevelander Hotel, this looks like an insane amount of shenanigans going on. And I'm told this is just a normal Friday in South Beach. And I am thrilled to be joined by the king of Miami and maybe the king of all sports media, the one and only Dan Le Batard. How are you?
Zach, you think that out there is crazy? You think that what's happening out there by the pool,
just a lot of people are having fun.
Yes, but that is Miami. That is why it is my favorite city.
This is a great city. And you know what? I was the guy when I was like 29, 28. It's like, oh, it's too cheesy for me. It's too clubby. Like, it's just, it's not my kind of town. Now, living here, I don't know. I'd have to experiment with it, but I have gone completely the other way. This city is awesome. The food is awesome. The weather's always good.
You just had your first cafecito. You have never had that crack cocaine coffee that's Cuban before. So that, we are happy to take your virginity.
I'm thrilled. I expected it to taste bad. It actually tasted great.
Yes. This is a lot of sugar. It's sugar, diesel, and crack.
And I'm told do not mess around. Do not, now that I've dipped my toe in, don't think I can go like all in.
Well, it is something that will give you a great deal of energy. So you have to be careful with that, especially if you have any heart ailments.
Why I wanted to have you on, other than you're Dan Le Batard and I'm in Miami, was all this decade retrospective coverage just happened in the NBA. Who's the team of the decade? Who's the player of the decade? And I didn't read all of it, but I read a lot of it. And in digesting it, I kept feeling like the LeBron, Wade, Bosh Heat are not coming up in this discussion as much as I thought. Part of that is just simply it was the beginning of the decade and we're all stupid and hardwired to remember what just happened. Part of it is that what just happened was the Warriors. And connected to that, LeBron went another place and won a championship and made four finals in a row, as he did in Miami. However, I do think, A, they haven't received as much attention as I thought, considering, and you wrote lovingly about it, how much of an event they were for 4 years. And two, I do think it is indicative of there is some sort of grappling going on with, like, how are we to reckon with what they accomplished? Where do they rank on the all-time scale? What happened and what do we think of it? But I want to go to you. Like, you haven't read all this coverage at all. Neither have I. But do you get that feeling that we've kind of, like, it's like we've moved on from that team almost?
Well, they started the trend, and then the trend got more fascinating because LeBron went from, if you watch the arc of it, he went from totally popular to that mysterious last game in Cleveland, and then he, much to his surprise, becomes unpopular all of a sudden and then makes the star turn later the way Tiger Woods does of back to popular again. It's the best way to go to fame. Famous, infamous, and then more famous. And so they were doing that at the beginning with great controversy, and that team was one shot away from being a tremendous underachiever, given how they came out of the box at the start of the decade, because people were really mad that they came out of the box as if they'd won a bunch of championships simply because at the last minute, the Heat rushed them on stage. They were still signing the contracts in the bowels of the arena, and then they come up for that ridiculous pep rally that was very Miami. That was not unlike the thing that you liked outside here, the Clevelander Hotel. We're good at the party, and that team was a party for 4 years.
The not one, not two, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that it was a pep rally as if they had won championship.
It was a mistake. I wonder if they knew as soon as LeBron said it, right? It was LeBron's words saying the not one, not two.
Yes.
I think it was him saying. I wonder if as those words came out of his mouth, he realized this is now going to haunt me no matter what happens.
Oh, I think he just injected Miami. I'm here and all of, look at this. Look at what has greeted us. Because imagine, I remember it was very funny to think back on it, But they came up on this stage and the three of them had their back to what they were coming up to. So they couldn't be totally sure what was behind them. And when the three of them turned around, Wade's like, this is my city. This feels cool. LeBron gets blown back a little, but is like, oh, I love being here. And Bosh is just stunned by the whole thing. Like, he just starts flexing and roaring and going all over the place as if he'd actually done something in a game, because it was just, yeah, they just injected from right there. They injected you from Miami to the United States, and now it was going to be back and forth. And Miami, the best sports experience Miami has ever had was those renegade hurricane teams that urinated all over sportsmanship. And it was, and yeah, us against them was a very real thing.
I was like the stupid 6 to 8 year old in the '80s when the Hurricanes were doing that, who I don't know why, maybe because my father is a coach and I was like, that's not nice to do.
That's right.
I was a little kid.
That was all of America.
They crossed the line.
That wasn't just you. That was all of America.
Now they're cool.
Yes.
It was really cool. By the time the Fab Five came along, I was a teenager and smart enough to realize they're cool.
Yes.
I don't care what kind of cheating is maybe going on. They're cool.
Right.
How is LeBron? So this is always Wade's town. It's always going to be Wade's town. LeBron is now in Kobe's town. It's always going to be Kobe's town. But LeBron left here, and as you wrote I was rereading some of your stuff this morning. When he left, you wrote about it did not end with good feelings between LeBron and the organization. What is he regarded as here? Is he's not quite like beloved, I don't think, right?
I'm just a wonderful mercenary who brought us 4 years. Like, there weren't burning jerseys here. Whatever anger there was in the Heat organization, because they were hurt by the fact that they were surprised the same way that Dan Gilbert was. But while you never like to have the feel good taken away, Miami wasn't, it didn't feel like unreasonably angry toward LeBron. Not in a way, like we weren't, they lost him the same way that they got him. They lost him in exactly the same way that they got him. And so I don't see how mad you could be at him. But he's not, he also wasn't here long enough for the feel good to be like echoing, enduring, where you develop the emotional attachment to him the way that you would to a Dwayne Wade.
I haven't been to a LeBron return game here, I don't think. What is it like when he comes back?
Well, most people are in the bathrooms doing blow. but after the video tributes or whatever, there's some indifferent booing, and not now. At this point, it's gone, I feel like. I feel like LeBron returning doesn't mean anything because he's had a couple of pit stops elsewhere. So, but the first time back, you remember what it was like when he returned to Cleveland with the Miami Heat.
I wasn't there, but I watched it on TV, and the people who were there say it's the worst thing they've ever seen.
It's crazy. Like, they were so bad to him on returning to Cleveland. Miami wasn't anything like that to him.
It's interesting also that Bosh has become a Miamian, that he's the last one. Even Wade is in LA now. Bosh is, it's, and he's at the games all the time. Every time I come here, he's at the game and he gets introduced and people love him. It's interesting how he became, you described him perfectly as like the third wheel who's like, what's happening here? What have I got myself into? And his first season, really his first two seasons, I mean, there were rocky, rocky emotional moments for him. And now this is his town. It's very interesting. He's really loved here.
He is loved here. He was always, I used to always, after talking to Chris Bosh, I would always thank him with like sincere, probably over the top appreciation for just the way that he is in terms of treating people. He got here, so clear on what it is that he wanted. Like, he came here and he's like, I want kids. I want to have a family. He wasn't here for the parts of Miami that are fun for the single NBA player. That's not what he was here for. He was here to make a family and make this his home, and it's what he did.
And he, of course, came back after LeBron left. It is interesting to go back and relive that summer with the plane tracking and the meeting in Vegas that I don't even remember when it got reported that they were meeting in Vegas and how short the meeting was. And then you look at, like, they really thought he was coming back. They drafted Napier. Then they got Josh McRoberts and Danny Granger, who were going to be like the veteran guys who could fit with LeBron. I mean, they really built a team for LeBron, and then LeBron went away.
They were surprised by it in ways that they probably shouldn't have been. And I remember at the time how upset Pat Riley was. And he is fortunate that he didn't get too emotional publicly, because it would have been bad on staining some of the end if he had if the anger of the moment, the flash of the moment, had been something that he decided to protect his ego with. Because if you remember some of the details on that back and forth, it felt a bit like Pat Riley was taken over to Vegas as a showpiece, as a chess piece. And so in the room, when he's in there with LeBron and Maverick and Randy when he's in the room with them, they barely would, they wouldn't look up away from the World Cup, or they wouldn't turn the sound down on it. Like, he's sitting there, he's pitching them, this guy who is respected in every basketball circle. And those guys in that room weren't terribly respectful from what the reports are.
Quip wants you to know the one single discovery that matters most for your dental care. It is simply this: that if you have good habits, you are good to go. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day, flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. Quip makes that simple, all of it, starting with electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer. That's handy, and 30-second pulses to guide a full and even clean, so you don't brush one side more than the other. The Quip floss dispenser, how cool does that sound, comes with pre-marked string to help you use just the right amount. Plus, Quip delivers a fresh brush head, floss, and toothpaste refill to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. You don't even have to think about it. It just arrives. Join over 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. Think about what you thought you would have to pay for a high-end electric toothbrush. And if you go to getquip.com/low, my last name, the name of this podcast, right now, you'll get your first refill pack free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/low. That's GETQUIP.com/low. Quip, the good habits company.
The big overarching story of their run, and I think, I don't know if it's the reason why he left, but it's the reason the team looked like it did when he left, is Wade's decline. If Wade's knees are okay, it's harder to leave, for sure. And I think, so I will put this to you. So they went 4 straight finals, 2 titles. As you said, they're a shot away from 1. In retrospect, this is a loaded question and I feel bad asking it. Are the Heatles a disappointment?
I think they are just spectacularly Miami in every way. They were loud. Like, a disappointment, yes, they probably should have won more than 2 if you're putting together that star power to get the Heat. But we all saw how hard it was. The reason people are still mad at Kevin Durant is because we saw how easy it was when he played on that team. LeBron gets here. They do that pep rally. We think it's going to be easy for them. And then we saw that it wasn't any kind of easy for them. And so begrudgingly, they end up taking our respect. I'm with you, though, that if Dwayne Wade had been able to remain healthy, you know, you've heard Pat Riley say that he was looking for a decade team. He thought when LeBron left, he thought a decade went out the window. One of those decade teams.
I mean, by the end, I think, I have no idea if they're perceived as a disappointment. I don't want to speak in the passive voice like people perceive them. I don't know if they are. I just, their lack of coverage in this particular window struck me. If they are, I think one of the, I'm not saying it's right. I'll get to my opinion. If they are, I think one of the reasons is that they went out with such a whimper against San Antonio. They just got rolled off the floor.
Zach, that happened so fast. If you go back to that series, Miami almost won both games in San Antonio. It was 1-1 coming back here for 3. And then San Antonio put together the best stretch of basketball I've ever seen a team put together over 3 games, where they, even Bosch was saying, like, it was bewildering to watch.
Bosch has spoken lovingly of those teams.
But it was it happened in 3 games. The whole thing ended in 3 games, like, which may be part of the reason that the Miami Heat weren't prepared for it. But I don't know if I've mentioned this to you before, but the Miami Heat had the feeling that over the part, the way that series fell apart, that LeBron wasn't totally present. That, and there's nothing in the stat line. I've disagreed with people in the organization about this. Like, there's nothing in the stat line that would suggest for a moment that LeBron wasn't trying maximum hard. But those results were so inept defensively for the Miami Heat that they've been, some folks have been left to wonder within the organization if just he was, you know, because LeBron can camouflage his interest on defense.
I think it's so fascinating to say that, because I think last year you would look at the stats and say, oh, it's LeBron's 27-7, 28-8-8. Like, he's having a great year. And you watch the games, you're like, he's not there the way he is.
And the same, that Cleveland game where he checked out and there were the Delonte West rumors and all this, stats were good. I mean, he wasn't shooting well, but it's not like he was 2 for 8 and with 4 assists. I mean, he has the ability. He's so good that he is going to put up juggernaut numbers just by having the ball and being on the court. As far as that series goes, I remember game 5 in San Antonio. They clinched in San Antonio.
Miami was up like 17 in the first half.
But you knew, like, we were talking in the press room. Here's how the game's going to go. LeBron's going to come out like a house of fire. The Heat are going to get a lead. The Spurs are going to chip away, and then they're just going to roll over and die. And that's like, by the end, it was a party. The whole fourth quarter was a party.
It's exactly how it happened. And that's how it ended. But it was fun. It's when I'm telling you about it being very Miami. Like, I don't know. You want to talk about it? Man, maybe it's excellent. Maybe it's mediocre. Maybe it underachieved. But yeah, we had a good time. Like, everybody was dancing and it was loud and, it was just a big Miami team. But if a free throw goes differently, if Kawhi Leonard or Manu Ginobili make a free throw, Miami wins one title. And I think that team is a lot closer to being, something that's funny instead of, remembered at all.
So the case for them being, it's not a disappointment, is too strong, but so they go to the finals the first year, and we'll talk about that Dallas series, all time flat.
But it's okay to say disappointment. It's a disappointment in the same way that Shaq's career was a disappointment. Sure. You know what I mean? Like, you're looking at it and you're saying, well, he's bigger, stronger, faster than everybody. Shouldn't he win all the titles every year? Shouldn't he be Wilt Chamberlain? But Shaq's career is, I mean, you could call it a disappointment, but there's nothing numerically that would suggest
Shaq's
it's disappointing.
Shaq's closer to being a top five player than he is to being the 10th best player.
Mm-hmm.
In the NBA, Shaq is ridiculous. And by the way, your point about the Warriors, I actually think the Warriors' run is an argument for the Heat not being a disappointment for this reason. They had Durant for 3 seasons. That team with Durant should be as close to an automatic championship as you can get. No one should be able to beat them. They win the first one easy. Houston almost beat them the second time, up 3-2. Chris Paul gets injured. I don't care if the chemistry was, they were having a bad series, Durant was isoing too much, there was some stuff going on with it. That's called sports. That's what happens. Like, Houston foisted that upon them, pushed them, and they didn't respond well until Chris Paul got hurt, and then they responded like gangbusters. And then they actually lost. So, like, if that team can come somewhat close to going 1-for-3, I think that shows you just how hard it is to win once in the NBA. And to me, that's the ultimate argument for why they're not a disappointment, is that it's just, it's no matter who you, it's really hard to win.
Zach, it is amazing just to look back at that Warriors team. You would think, as easy as it was, easy in quote marks, as it was for them to win the title, because they had by far the most talented team every time they were out there, for them to be just fundamentally physically broken, mentally, physically, and not wanting to be around each other anymore. Like, that should tell you how difficult it is to, like, those guys should have been hogging championships for the decade. They should have been just sitting there playing together, if it was about winning and only winning, to enjoy themselves for 10. They would have been the Celtics of Red Auerbach.
So Heat lose the first year. 2012 and 2013, they win. 2013 is their best team. It's the team that won 27 games in a row. They were 45-3 over 48 games going into the Pacers series, which was the conference finals. And then 2014, we just talked about. 2012 and 2013 are not like super convincing playoff runs. 2012 is the Boston series in the conference finals where they're down 3-2. Boston reels off 3 straight. Paul Pierce hits a 3 here in game 5 and jaws at the whole world.
Blueprint, I'm convinced, was on the line there.
Like, well, blueprint. That's what I was going to ask. So they go to game 6 and LeBron plays what most people within the Heat would say is the most consequential game of his career in Boston. I think he was 19 of 26 at 40-something points. It was just, it came out and it was the all-time, we are not losing, I am single-handedly winning the game performance.
One of the most badass performances I've ever seen across sport.
Yeah. That Boston team that was the lockout year. I think they were, I'm going to look it up right now.
Sort of a sagging, veteran, tired dynasty.
They were
39
and 27. They were the fourth seed. Like, that's not that great. Mm-hmm. The injury to
Derek. They were so old at that point, right, though, weren't they? Wasn't it like at that time none of those guys would play back-to-backs?
At that time, the Celtics have already thought, have we held on to him too long? Uh-huh. Like, they've already had that discussion internally. Have we missed the boat on trading these guys? We're screwed. And the broader point is that Derrick Rose's injury really took away what should have been Miami's rival for the full stretch of their championship. So of their run. So 2012, they barely eke by a Boston team. That's what I was going to ask you. If they lose that game, do we have any idea what happens?
I don't think they break apart the Wade LeBron thing, but I do think that the Miami Heat might get engulfed. Now, they've said otherwise, and we'll never know, right? Because they've said otherwise. They've said publicly, nah, it wouldn't have broken up.
But there was
so much pressure at that point, and the noise was so loud, and they were being covered in such an unprecedented fashion. Like, where, when do you remember ESPN covering anything that way, where it would be a proper Miami Heat reporter to just follow the team around? Like, they engulfed ESPN because they were a polarizing team. And I just thought the heat of the noise of that was so loud at that point. Another offseason laughing at the Miami Heat. Another offseason after LeBron had already like gone Tom Hanks in Castaway because he couldn't post up JJ Barea in the surprising finals. Like, that would have, I believe the pressure of that would have made them, they wouldn't have come back for a third year as is.
I don't know what I believe, except for this. No matter what they say publicly, I don't think they know. I don't think they know how they would have responded to exactly the situation you just described, because it would have been hysteria. It would have been hysteria, and Bosch had already had already bared his soul, like, multiple times by that point. And I don't know if he becomes, if it just starts getting speculated that are they going to move him, like, I don't know if, what happens? I don't know if there's coming back from that. That game, and once they won that game, you know they're winning Game 7. Mm-hmm. And once they get to the Thunder.
Well, they were an underdog against it. The Thunder were favored in that series. The Thunder, at that point, it had been such a labor. It had been such a struggle. That team was totally, there's revisionist history there. That team was an underdog.
I picked the Thunder.
In the final.
At Grantland.com, I picked the Thunder.
And we thought the Thunder would win the next five titles because they had, I mean, they had all those guys under 25 years old, Harden, Westbrook, Durant, and Ibaka, you know, depending on what you believe about Ibaka's birth certificate.
During that playoff run, one of the things that makes it a little better than it looks in 2012 is that Bosch was injured. Bosch was injured during game one of the Pacers series, which was the second round, the first of three straight Indiana-Miami series, and missed the first four games of the Boston series, maybe the first five.
Zach, that team was so doubted during all that time that I went on the radio and I nationally had an argument with Stephen A. Smith where I was indignant that he would take Tim Duncan as the guy he would face LeBron with instead of what I was nominating, Roy Hibbert. Roy Hibbert, because he terrified LeBron so much and he fouled up everything that was happening with the Heat so much that I was taking Roy Hibbert as a game-changing center only to stop or bother LeBron James. He walked into a practice facility during that series, and LeBron was like taking baby hooks and stuff, trying to work on something. And they're like, are you really going to invent? You're going to invent a new part of your game for this scarecrow?
Who's soon to be out of the league. Bosch got hurt in 2012 playoff run. And in doing so, Miami accidentally stumbles into the way that it figures out it should play, which is LeBron at the four, Battier at the four. They start Battier, and then Bosch plays center, and they've now found their identity. That's how they should play. The next year, is the year they go crazy. They win 27 in a row. They're totally blitzing the whole league. They finish 66-16. It's a humiliation. It's embarrassing. They're so much better than everyone else. Then they get to the Pacers in the conference finals. The Pacers in 2012-13, I believe, were 49-32. Like, whoop-de-freaking-do.
Mm-hmm.
The Heat were 45-3. Going into the series.
Mm-hmm.
And they took him to seven.
Because of Hibbert. What do you think made me so crazy arguing with Stephen A. Smith? That's why I was on. Hibbert made him crazy. Hibbert was the scariest thing in that entire four-year run because everyone could see that LeBron didn't know what to do against a 7'3" scarecrow.
That was the series. Game one is when they take Hibbert out and LeBron hits the layup at the buzzer to win the game. And he had an and one before, or a layup before that with like 12 seconds left to put them up by two or three. An and one to put them up by three. Paul George then gets fouled shooting a three, I think makes all three. Whatever. A classic, all-time classic game. Some things I forgot from that series and from that season. I just got through saying that they revolutionized their own identity in the league by starting Bosch at center and playing small. Udonis Haslem started 59 games in 2012-13 and started, I think, every playoff game until the finals in the middle of the series, and they flipped him out for Mike
Miller.
He
had one big game against the Pacers, there somewhere, where all of a sudden they called it Hasliming, right? Where to lay off of somebody, to just let someone shoot. Was it the Phoenix Suns? Somebody called it Hasliming. It was the game plan, and in that game they Haslamed by just letting him shoot jumpers, and he did, and he made them.
I think it was game two. No, I don't remember when it was. In the previous series against the Pacers in 2012, he had also had a big game. And that's the series when, you remember that, they're down, in 2012, they were down 2-1 to the Pacers, and LeBron and Wade had maybe their most synergistic game together in game four. 70 points combined.
But let me ask you this. If you're doing sort of their place in history, as a guy who knows this part of the evolution, the positionless stuff, like, that's the mark on how basketball changed throughout this decade, right? The fact that they decided to play with a team that didn't have a center, because back then, at the time, we were having legitimate arguments about would you start a team, you know, a few years earlier, LeBron James or Dwight Howard. That was something that was,
yeah,
like, and then the whole sport changed right there.
Yeah, and LeBron moving to the four, a move he had resisted for a long time, I think, and surrounding him with shooting. And Bosh at center and the way they blitz pick and rolls. And just like my point in bringing up Haslam was they've still played big a fair amount, or with two traditional bigs, or Bosh is not really traditional, but you get what I'm saying. They would still play Bosh at center a lot. Part of what happened is they discovered how good they were with Bosh at center. And part of what happened is that Wade and LeBron just got more comfortable playing together. And you could see it in just the way they moved the ball started to change. They would just have these possessions of like 5, 6, 7, boom, 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 screen, give, go. And it was like legitimately, 2013 was legitimately beautiful basketball until that Pacers series where it got a little ugly.
Hibbert. I'm telling you, Hibbert. Going in there, fouling everything up. He made me crazy, Zach. He made me crazy. I argued that you got to take Roy Hibbert over Tim Duncan if you're facing LeBron in a playoff series. It's an argument I made.
Someone brought up Hibbert to me last night at the Heat game, actually, and said, all these teams are now dropping back and pick and roll on defense the way Hibbert would, just hang around the rim. The Lopez brothers, Rudy Gobert, on and on. Could he actually be back in the league if he wanted to? And I said, he didn't get out of the league because of his defense. He was run out of the league because he couldn't do anything on offense anymore. He couldn't shoot. He couldn't rim run. He couldn't do it. But his career arc in this whole, as a side character in this whole Heat thing, is like really fascinating.
But to your point, though, how good were you really if you were nearly neutered by Hibbert?
Well, and so all of this is Derrick Rose gets injured, and all of these sort of, like, the Pacers sort of rise up into this, like, semi-void in the East. And, like, in the big picture, they're not that, like, they were the third seed that year. The Knicks were the second seed. They're a good team. They matched up well with the Heat, but they were a good team that was inflated by how bad the East was, top to bottom. And, like, in the macro sense, there's no metric that screams out, like, this is like a championship-caliber team. And the Heat limped by them. But, as you said, they were a really good matchup for Miami. They defended the hell out of them. Paul George was, like, exploding onto the scene. Those were fun series.
Is your larger point, though, that one of the reasons that perhaps Miami gets overlooked for that four-year period is because there wasn't excellence to meet them? There wasn't enough excellence
to meet them. The East got great once LeBron left. And all the other teams are like, okay, now we can win. Or Giannis is the Giannis and the Sixers sort of naturally emerge into their primes. But the East was just, it was really, really bad. I'd have to really study it. The East might have been better during his time in Cleveland than it was during his time in Miami. The competition to get out of the East might have been better.
And you can say, if you were looking to diminish what it is that they accomplished, that what was coming to meet them in the finals from the Western Conference had been a great attrition, right? When you go from James Harden, Kevin Durant, and Russell Westbrook together to all of a sudden the Popovich Spurs, the Dallas Mavericks, those are all very different teams. You know what I mean? And you didn't know who the hell was going to come out of the
West. That's why the argument, they're one shot away from going 1-3. It's interesting, but you could do that to a lot of teams that won championships. If not for this, then this. If not for this, then this. And it's not persuasive so much to me also because those two Spurs teams were awesome. Historically awesome teams. The team that beat them in the finals, the Spurs team of 2014, the revenge team, at the time, I think had the best scoring margin through the playoffs of any team ever in the history of the NBA. They destroyed everybody, including the Heat. The Thunder were the only team that pushed them. Well, actually, Dallas took them to seven randomly in the first round. But the bottom line is they were an unbelievable team. To split against that team, that's a nice outcome. I don't care if it took a crazy Ray Allen shot. You were at that game, I assume, right?
Yes.
I was not at that game. What are your memories from? Where are you? Are you still in your proper seat when the shot happened?
I was still in my seat, yes. As I recall, we were making fun of Stugatz because he had left the arena and was trying to get back in.
He was one of those guys.
Yes. He went and he was like banging on the door. I remember being bothered that everything that team had been through, that so many people were leaving so fast, just because I thought that team deserved better. As somebody who, I hadn't been writing about sports. It had been many years since I'd written about sports, and there was that team, that electricity, that connection to the city, that vibrance. I was working that night, as I was many of those nights writing, and I was just sort of stupefied. Like, I sat there. I didn't process all of it the way that you normally would if you were just watching a game. I was confused. Like, did that just happen? Wait a minute. Because the size of it, that so much had built up to that moment over 3 years. 3 years, right? Was it 3 years?
It's their third year together. Yeah.
It just sort of felt like it mattered in a really unusual way. And I was in that moment, not much of a professional.
Well, hey, look, I don't know what I did on my, I was not at the game. I probably fell off my couch in astonishment that it happened. It's the greatest shot ever. I think it's better than the Kyrie Irving. Sure, better is the wrong word, but I think it's the greatest shot ever. And it's why they signed Ray Allen. That's why Ray Allen went there, and you know, they're it's not an accident that he hit that
the
shot.
Precision of it is nuts, though.
Yeah.
Like when you go back and you know how meticulous Ray was, like the number of things that have to be coordinated for him to know the spacing on the floor, you know how obsessive compulsive he was about preparation,
yeah.
Right? And so if you could deconstruct like the steps he had to take to know where he was for them not to have to go to replay to find out whether or not he was actually behind the 3-point line or not. That was pretty cool. It was a cool moment.
Well, I got to go back and read. Did you write a game story? Like a column from the game or something? I got to go back and see that.
I just remember reading some of the details. This was afterward. This would require some reporting on just how many years of preparation went into the specifics of Ray Allen knowing how to get to that corner that way, because that situation was not unique to him because of the number of times in practice. I mean, I don't know if Ray did have OCD, but the way that he was would practice would be kind of OCD. And so he just sort of knew the dimensions of the court by feel.
And then, of course, they go on to win Game 7. It's actually, when you think about the emotional gut punch, it's to the Spurs' credit that Game 7 was as close as it was and required a couple big defensive plays and a big LeBron jumper to win the game. And that was a tight game all the way through.
Is that the one where Duncan missed the layup? That was like, with 2 minutes left, they almost lost Game 7.
One of the only times you will ever see Tim Duncan show frustration on the floor. I believe he slapped the floor.
Yeah, he was really angry with himself
after he missed that shot. And then for the Spurs, and the Spurs just were out for blood the whole next year. They regrouped from that. I'm not sure any team has ever regrouped from a gut punch. And that's not even a gut punch. That's like your guts are literally ripped out and thrown
off. That is stunning, though, isn't it, that team just didn't break at that point?
No.
That somehow that all those guys would come back at that age and put on that particular onslaught where they ended the Miami Heat with a total whimper. That entire experiment ended the wrong way. All that loud noise ends at the end with a whimper because of just how good San Antonio was.
With the Spurs passing circles around them and Ginobili on an injured leg dunking on Bosch in the last game in San Antonio. And Ginobili didn't dunk all that much by that point in his career. Sometimes for inspiration, you just have to look up. For more than 60 years, the Goodyear blimp has fueled greatness on the gridiron by providing aerial coverage of some of the most legendary moments in college football history. When the Goodyear blimp rises above a stadium and inspires players to reach higher and rise to the challenge of the game's biggest moments, now it's your turn to go further with Goodyear. Discover tires made to rise above the rest. Learn more at Goodyear.com. Goodyear, more driven. To me, one of the games I always remember, it might be one of my top 10 games ever, just from like since I've been doing this professionally, was game six of the Spurs Thunder Conference Finals to get into the finals that in 2014.
Oh, I remember watching that game in a bar. That game was crazy.
So if that series went, and remember that the Thunder in 2012 had upset the Spurs, who had won 20 in a row to get to the finals. That the Thunder were a bad matchup for the Spurs, and the Spurs knew it. Ibaka missed the first two games.
Because they were so much younger. Like, they just felt like all fast twitch muscle fiber.
Just arms everywhere. Arms and dudes jumping in my face. And the Spurs geezers are like, yeah, we're smart and we can pass. But, like, these arms, there's a lot of arms all around me right now.
It's like the athletic guys at the Y playing against the dad who's 45 years old but has played for a long time. And he's got, like, the roly-poly pudgy moves and stuff.
Yeah. Once the athletic guys figure it out a little bit, the old guy's in a little bit more trouble than he thinks. Ibaka misses the first two games. Spurs go up 2-0. Thunder roar back 2-2 when Ibaka returns. Spurs win game five at home 3-2. Game six in OKC, Tony Parker gets hurt in the first half. They throw Corey Joseph in, who's like an unknown, seldom used, and he scores a couple baskets, plays well, and I think it's close or tied or something at halftime. And then it's close the entire second half. It goes to overtime. Kawhi Leonard has an insane chase down block of Russell Westbrook somewhere. That series was... That was the test. I think once the Spurs got by that, I've never really talked with them about that. I bet they viewed that as like, we respect the Heat, but I think they were pretty confident in that series against the Heat that they were going to win that series. I think Oklahoma City was almost as much of a bugaboo for them.
The Spurs can feel pretty good about the idea. I know it's looked back on as the Warriors doing it, but the Spurs in some ways can feel pretty good about ending both the Miami thing and the OKC thing, because the OKC thing was supposed to be a lot bigger and better than it was. And San Antonio, with its ability to old man their way past that OKC team, like, I don't know if Westbrook and Durant's relationship ever recovered from it, because you remember during that series, it was all, I think that's where it started. Hey, this Westbrook's inefficient. Like, he's, I felt like that was the series where that began. I might be wrong about that.
It was already going on before then, but maybe it exploded in that series.
But
maybe,
like, Meat Shield, he's the Meat Shield for Durant. Durant never gets any criticism. It's all Russell Westbrook's fault, even if he scores 45. I felt like it started during that series. My recollection might be wrong, but you were ahead of the game mathematically then. You were doing more efficiency analysis before then, so you might have been talking
maybe,
about it.
Maybe, I don't know.
Then.
I've never been a huge Russ guy. He's a great player. I just think he's a little overrated, that's all.
But it's the inefficiency that bothers you.
Yeah, it's hard to – he shoots really poorly. There's just no way around it.
One of the worst three-point shooters by volume in the history of the league.
The worst.
The worst?
I just know the Spurs, when that series was tied 2-2 with the Thunder, they were really, really worried. From talking to people in that team, they were – there was a moment where they were like, does this team just have our number? It's all we've worked for. Is that looming?
Imagine being an old guy, a Kevin Durant specimen, an extraterrestrial that didn't exist in the league before he brought it, like that, where it's a 7-footer it's a guy who under another time in America would have been asked to be Duncan. He's coming down the court playing against Duncan. I think Duncan was already looking old by that series,
sure.
Wasn't he?
He had better playoff runs than people remember them, but it was, I mean, he retired 2 years later. So it was sort of 2 or 3 years later. I don't know, but it was coming. Steven Adams was on my podcast last week and we talked about how he was on the bench during that game six. He's a rookie and he remembers thinking, this is a privilege to watch, like to watch the level of basketball. We'll end with this. Ultimately, I don't think the Heat are a disappointment. I don't buy that just because of what I just said before. It's too hard to win. You win two titles in 4 years. Yeah, it didn't last as long as you wanted. You didn't get a 6, 7, 8.
Let me ask you this question, though. If one free throw goes differently, is your answer different to that question? If one free throw in the San Antonio game.
Yeah, it probably is. If they lose, if they're 1-3 in the finals, I think I'm sorry, they're a disappointment.
That's funny to say, though.
It's
right?
Weird.
That's the line that you're an analytics guy. You're a guy who knows how to measure greatness in sports and value in sports. And one free throw by San Antonio.
You're making me seem dumb.
No, but that's the conundrum of it. That's why it's not clear cut about what that team was. Winning half the time, because when they got up on that stage and jumped around and did the parade, it wasn't to, hey, we're going to win half of them. Like, that's not what they were doing,
you know,
up there.
As much as you're, I've written about this sometimes before, as much as you're right about, you know, I'm all, analytics and big picture trends and you know, the flip of a coin and the whatever, the flap of a butterfly wing. It's still about winning. You got to win. And I don't care. Like, it's like the Warriors 73-win season. They were disappointed by it. It didn't matter that they won 73 games. You got to win. Like, at some point, you got to win. And if the Warriors had won two titles in 5 years, given the personnel they had instead of three, is it fair to say that's a disappointment? Probably, maybe. I don't know. It's like, at some point, all the excuses, all the randomness, all the luck, all the bounces of the ball, if you're there long enough, that stuff is going to even out. And, like, you just got to win. You got to win. And, like, the Ray Allen shot, was it lucky that the Spurs missed a free throw? Sure, I guess. Was it lucky that the rebound bounced right to Bosch and Bosch Newark? I guess. But they were close enough to still be within striking distance. And, like, the great teams, that's what they do. They dig deep and they find a way to take advantage of a bounce or whatever. And, like, Ray Allen and Chris Bosch made an all-time great play, and they won the series. And then they had to win Game 7, and they won Game 7. So I don't – it is funny to think that way, but the bottom line is they won. And two championships in 4 years, the longevity of it is a disappointment. But that four-year team, I don't know if we'll see it's not even the Warriors were the same in terms of the level of coverage.
In terms of fun, trying to think in your career, over your lifetime, because that is the most fun team I've ever covered in Miami sports, and that's going back to the 80s. In your lifetime in this sport, fun teams. I mean, it's Showtime Lakers are before your time, right?
Yeah, I'm a kid. I'm 11, 10 years old.
So, when you think of fun teams, because I feel like they brought a resurgence of interest by getting together because they were this weirdly famous Kardashian thing.
The decision is the biggest. Is there a bigger sports media event in the last 10 years than the decision?
It'd be hard to come by than a guy announcing his free agency. And from there, announcing, right, a change in the sport that turns into what it is today that none of us could have seen coming, where everyone all of a sudden figures out that one of the shots has more value than the other shots.
The one worth three.
The one worth three. Everyone figures out the three that is more than two all of a sudden. That television show signaled LeBron James owning the decade. Hell, man, he's turned our network into an infomercial for him. Like, that's crazy. We didn't cover Michael Jordan this way at ESPN.
Yeah, it's cute that the New York Times gave Player of the Decade to Stephen Curry. It's also wrong. And I don't care if you, like, I love Steph. He revolutionized the game, all that. LeBron was in the finals 8 years in a row. And the first team to revolutionize the NBA as a business entity in this decade was the Miami Heat because of how he came here and because of the star power. And they were fun, to your point, because they were villainous and vulnerable at the same time. Like, you could, by the time they made the playoffs, you could talk yourself into, like, oh, they can be beaten. And boy, every neutral fan was like, we want to see them lose. The Warriors were only villainous when they were essentially unbeatable, or they only lost when they had so many guys hurt that the Warriors were popular. The Heat were villains, and it's just fun. It's fun to have a villain.
I feel like there were legitimate reasons to doubt them at every place along the path. And when most of the people listening to this, I'm thinking, aren't going to remember that the Heat were an underdog in that final series against
people will not remember that
OKC because of the size of the doubt around everything that was happening around that team.
And people will remember 9-8, which was their record after 17 games, and when LeBron bumped Spo on the way off the court. Spo is like this grizzled veteran now. He was in his third year as head coach when that bump happened. Mm-hmm. He was a baby entrusted. I don't mean that pejoratively. I'm just saying he was Luke Walton. He was a kid as a coach. Entrusted to that. That's a crazy story in and of itself.
It is. And it speaks, I mean, you know about what the Miami Heat culture is. And I'm not talking about the way that they use it as sports athletic cliche. I'm talking about they've got so many loyalists in the organization, like people who have never worked for anybody else, people who only know you leave Riley's side and you are no longer his friend, or you work for him for an eternity. And Spo was one of those guys who came up through the bowels of the arena from the video room, and they worked with him. And he had quite the support system because LeBron couldn't nuke his coach.
Nope.
But couldn't do it, even though I mean, think about what we're talking about. A third-year coach against the size of LeBron James, he couldn't do it because he couldn't go at Riley that way. But over the next few years, culminating with him breaking up with Riley in a way that left Riley heartbroken, LeBron did realize, hey, wait a minute, Phil Jackson and Pat Riley don't need to be the governor of me anymore. I'm going to be the governor of me, and I'm going to hire my friends and empower them to support what it is that I'm doing. The next thing you know, Phil Jackson's out the door calling his crew a posse as they take over the whole league.
And by the way, you wrote about this when it happened. That's what powerful people do. And LeBron was painted as a villain again for wanting to exercise that level of power. But anybody with that level of power will try to exercise it. That's what they do. And you had a piece in your column that I was reading about. Everyone here is, you know, there's sore feelings that LeBron flew Pat Riley out to Vegas as a showpiece to show the Cavs that, yeah, Miami is possible and you, Cleveland, better give me everything I want. But if the Heat flew some marginal player from wherever to Miami to cut him, we wouldn't say boo. And that's what you wrote. And your coverage of it in retrospect was very fair and very prescient. Prescient? I don't know how to say that.
Prescient.
About like trade demands, trade requests, all this stuff. It's just players. It's players evening the scales. It's not players tipping them out of balance. It's players saying, hey, wait a second. I've got power too, and I'm going to use it.
Well, what he's realized, what's clear that he's realized, and Windhorse's book, is it out? It's been out. About the business.
Yes, it's good.
Of LeBron James. He realized somewhere within there, and maybe it was when he said, no, I'm not taking less anymore. Max contract, period, was the first thing you heard reported accurately when he came out. It's going to be the max contract somewhere. He realized somewhere in this that he is dramatically underpaid. When Gerrit Cole is getting $324 million guaranteed and LeBron James in Los Angeles is getting $150 million because his sport happens to be salary capped for 4 years. Lakers are getting LeBron James for 4 years at $150 million. He realized somewhere within that, no, there have to be other ways for me to make giant money and use my power and get my influence. And he's realized all those things.
Well, thank you for taking some time. It's just a general feeling I had that we've moved on too quickly from those teams. And I wanted to talk about them. And I was in Miami and I couldn't think of anyone better to talk about them.
I love those teams, man. I loved everything about what they did for this city. I mean, it was a really cool time.
And just they were just a monster, an entertainment monster who won two championships, and they've been a little overshadowed. So thank you for Dan Le Batard for coming on and taking us through what they
did. You were just trying to scam a trip to South Beach in January for you and your family so you can be in 80 degrees. That's all you were trying to do.
Did I time a Heat-related story or the reporting around it for the winter? Maybe. Am I going to regret that? I am not going
to
regret
it. You're not
going
to regret it. I am telling everyone at ESPN that Zach Lowe simply did this, decided whether or not that Heat team from 2010 was or wasn't a disappointment, that he built that around his entire family calendar schedules because he wanted to get to the beach in
January. No comment, Dan Le Batard. No comment. Thank you, sir. You all know Dan Le Batard. Find him all over the place. He's the best in the business. Thank you.
Thank you, buddy.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.